From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's a big day for death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. He and his lawyers are back in court today to introduce new evidence in his case.
He's like a lot of people who've spent more than a decade on death row. He's had nothing but loss after loss, one court after another denying him, one set of attorneys after another not adequately representing him. And I think finally Mumia is seeing that with his case being hard fought, with the support around his case increasing, his case is finally getting the attention of courts, and hopefully it will ultimately turn around and he will get a new trial.
Will Judge Szabo agree to hear the testimony of Veronica Jones? We'll speak with Abu-Jamal's attorney, Leonard Weinglass. The Middle East summit comes to Washington. What are President Clinton's goals?
How can we restore calm? What can we do to bring an end to the violence? How can we re-engage so that the process is advanced rather than slipping away into turns to reversing course?
We'll have a debate on U.S. policy in the Middle East and a preview of the first ever national Latino march on Washington. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. States today begin receiving the first of $16.5 billion of welfare funds to spend as they please under the welfare repeal law. 11 states have already filed their plans. Republican Governor William Weld's Massachusetts has one of the toughest, limiting benefits and requiring most beneficiaries with school-age children to work within 60 days. Workers making minimum wage get a 50 cents pay increase today. That puts the wage at $4.75. Meanwhile, nearly all the House's GOP members, joined by three Democrats, have asked Clinton to promise he won't grant presidential pardons to his former associates convicted in the Whitewater affair. Convicted in May on Whitewater-related fraud charges were Jim and Susan McDougal and former Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker. Bob Dole returns to the campaign trail today, this time in Ohio, but the Republican presidential nominee will be keeping his eye on the Mideast summit in Washington. Yesterday, he issued a statement calling on the Clinton administration to follow a clear and decisive line during the talks. Dole is throwing his, quote, full support to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Dole says the U.S. should not ask Israel to make any concessions in the hope of ending the latest violence. Ross Perot's argument to join the presidential debates will be heard in federal court in Washington today. A bipartisan commission voted to exclude the Reform Party's candidate, saying it didn't believe Perot had a realistic chance of being elected. Perot sued to be included in the nationally televised debates, the first of which is Sunday in Hartford, Connecticut. The Natural Law Party will also be in court, and the Green Party has sued the commission as well. And you're listening to Democracy Now! For the first time in over a year, Mumia Abu-Jamal will appear in a Philadelphia courtroom. Abu-Jamal is the African-American journalist and commentator who's been on death row since 1982, when he was convicted of killing Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, a crime Abu-Jamal says he did not commit. For the past few years, attorneys have been trying to get Abu-Jamal a new trial because of judicial bias. Today's hearing will determine whether the court will allow new evidence of police misconduct in Abu-Jamal's case. We now turn to Leonard Weinglass, the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mr. Weinglass, what do you expect to happen in court today?
Well, the picture of what's going to go on in court today is much clearer as of yesterday. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court came down with a new amended order, clearly defining what this hearing is about. The last time we were in court on September 18th, pursuant to an order of the Supreme Court, Judge Szabo indicated that he was confused as to what the court meant, as to whether or not he should hear the testimony of witness Veronica Jones. We thought that order was very clear. In any event, he asked us to return on October 1st, and he would inquire of the Supreme Court as to the meaning of their order. And yesterday, on September 30th, the Supreme Court came down with a new order that made it very clear, demanding this time that Judge Szabo hold, to use their words, a full factual hearing concerning the claims regarding Veronica Jones. So we anticipate that at the hearing today, we will finally hear from Veronica Jones in person.
Can you tell us what Veronica Jones has to say, who she is and what she saw?
Veronica Jones is a witness who testified at the original trial. And she testified that no one ran from the scene of the shooting after the shots were fired and the officer fell to the ground. Actually, three other witnesses said that they saw someone run, but two of them were precluded from testifying or changed their testimony. And when Veronica Jones was called to the stand, she denied that anyone ran from the scene of the shooting, leaving only Mumia and his brother there with the officer as the primary suspects. We knew that Veronica Jones had, a week after the shooting, told the police that she saw two people run from the scene. But when she took the stand 6 months later and testified at the trial, she denied seeing anyone run. And when we located her this year, she confessed that she testified falsely, and that in fact she had seen two people run from the scene of the shooting, but that she testified falsely because the police had visited her just days before she took the stand and while she was in custody and told her that she faced a mandatory 5 to 15 years in prison on a gun charge, and if she wouldn't cooperate with the police on the Jamal case, she would have to leave her three children, she was then 21 years old, and do her time. And so she changed her testimony and denied seeing anyone run. Mm-hmm. Now she's willing to admit to all of this.
Mm-hmm. Who was she, and why was she there? Why was she an eyewitness to this case?
Well, at the time, on December 9th, 1981, Veronica, who, as I mentioned, was then 21 years old, was a prostitute, a working prostitute, and working on the street. And this particular incident happened in an area that's known as the red light district of Philadelphia. And she heard the shots. She was very nearby. She took cover behind a building and looked around the corner of the building, saw the officer fall, and saw two men run from the scene.
Why should people believe she'll tell the truth today any more than she told the truth then?
Well, that's a good question, because apparently people believe that witnesses always do show up, particularly where there's an execution that's scheduled, and they say things that there may or may not be a basis in truth for saying. With Veronica, the case is different, because 1 week after the shooting occurred, Veronica did give a statement to the police in which she said she did see two men run from the scene. So she's not making up a story now. She told the truth within a week of the shooting. It was 6 months later when she got on the stand that she denied ever making that statement, and that was the falsehood. So in this particular instance, there's a clear record of what Veronica saw.
Why isn't Veronica Jones afraid today as she was in 1981?
Well, 15 years have elapsed. Her life has changed. Her three young daughters are now grown, young women. Two are in college. She is no longer a prostitute. She has a regular job. She doesn't live in the city of Philadelphia or in the state of Pennsylvania. She's no longer afraid. Her life has changed. It's turned around quite a bit. And she now feels, as a matter of good conscience, that she has to come forward and tell the truth.
How did you find her?
It was difficult to find Veronica, because when she was arrested, she gave two or three false names. She gave three false addresses. She gave false Social Security numbers. She did not have regular employment or a regular residence at the time. We had to start and look for Veronica, and we looked in Connecticut, we looked in Florida, we looked in New Jersey, in Maryland, and it was just a stroke of good luck that we were able to locate her. But Veronica, like a number of other witnesses in this case, were people who were on the street at 4 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of those folks did not have jobs, used false names and false Social Security numbers. So our investigation, which has been massive, we've used over 11 investigators, and it's been very expensive, incidentally, has combed the country looking for people who are very difficult to find. And we haven't found all of them.
You interviewed other witnesses yesterday. Will you be bringing other people forward in Judge Szabo's court today?
Well, I think the Supreme Court has clarified the issues as to what's to be heard during this hearing. Prior to getting the Supreme Court's order of September 30th, we weren't sure what we would have to show in Judge Szabo's court. So we brought in all of our investigators who worked on the Veronica Jones issue, two of them coming in from California, one coming down from Connecticut, one from New Jersey. And we gathered them all together in case we would have to present evidence as to the extent of our search for Veronica. But now that the Supreme Court has clarified it, I think it's very clear that we don't have to present that evidence after all. At least that's going to be our position, and that the Supreme Court does want to hear directly from Veronica.
Now to the issue of Judge Szabo, who in some ways became a joke when you went to court a year ago. Judge Szabo, who sometimes would just walk out of the courtroom, and even the guards in the courtroom didn't know what to do, whether to remove Mumia Abu-Jamal or to bring him back in. Why should he grant you anything?
Well, frankly, we're very fortunate in having the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania now directly order him to hear the testimony of Veronica Jones. We left the court last time very unsure of whether or not Veronica Jones would ever be heard, or whether Judge Szabo would succeed in disappearing this witness. So I think the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, which reversed him earlier on a procedural point, and I believe now again, is pretty aware of Judge Szabo. He's been reversed on death penalty cases more than any other judge in this state. And so I think they know his track record. I think they know where he's coming from. And I think the court was very clear this time in seeing to it that Judge Szabo has no wiggle room, but will have to allow Veronica to testify.
We're talking to Len Weinglass, who is the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. He is going to court later this morning. Mumia Abu-Jamal will be in the courtroom. On the issue of Judge Szabo, just a week ago on September 24th, you filed an emergency motion urging the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to remove Judge Albert Szabo from the case. Why didn't they do it, and what were your grounds for asking for this?
We asked them to remove Judge Szabo because the Supreme Court on September 4th had entered what's called a remand order, directing Judge Szabo, we believe, to take the testimony of Veronica Jones. When we came to court on September 18th with Veronica so she could testify, the judge indicated that he didn't understand the order. And in fact, he proceeded to say things in a very negative and surprisingly hostile way about the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania and refused to hear her testimony at that time and indicated that he's not sure that he would ever let her testify. We then filed an emergency application to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, informing them that Judge Szabo was frustrating their order of September 4th and asking the court to remove Judge Szabo. What the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania did is they denied that request, but instead they entered a very specific order giving very clear directions to Judge Szabo that he would have to hear the testimony of Veronica Jones. So I think we accomplished what we set out to do, which was to open the door for her testimony.
Okay, so what does it mean? She absolutely will be able to testify?
We're 99% sure. I would really be shocked and surprised if something developed in court that prevented her from testifying.
And so let's say he does let Veronica Jones testify. What does that mean? What will happen next?
Well, what happens immediately is Judge Szabo is under order then to write an opinion within 30 days, including findings of fact respecting her testimony and conclusions of law. Those findings of fact and conclusions of law, together with the transcript of her testimony, then becomes part of the record, and it goes back up to the Supreme Court, which all this time has retained jurisdiction of the case. And now this part, this piece of the appeal, is now considered part of the regular record and will be considered together with the other 21 or 22 claims that we made as to why Mumia should get a new trial.
Do you believe that Mumia Abu-Jamal will get a new trial?
I do believe that he will get a new trial. I think that it was clearer that he would receive a new trial before the new death penalty, Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 was passed. It's an act which virtually strips the federal court of making a meaningful review of the state court process in a capital case. As you probably know, previously 40% of all state death convictions were reversed by federal judges who found violations of federal law. The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 makes that much more difficult because it restricts the breadth and the scope of the review that federal courts can engage in. This has a large impact on Mumia's case. We were always dubious of whether or not we could get a just result from the state of Pennsylvania, but we were relatively confident that we had a much better chance in the federal system. Now that opportunity, that opening, has been pretty much blocked, and we're very concerned about that.
So this is retroactive. This applies. This new law does apply to Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We believe it does, although we will be arguing that it doesn't have retroactive effect. But the indications are that they will apply this law retroactively.
What is Mumia Abu-Jamal's state of mind right now?
Well, Mumia is in Philadelphia. He's been brought here from Greene County, which is the furthest western part of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mumia was visited yesterday in Philadelphia, and he appears to be strong and confident now that Veronica will be able to testify and explain that Mumia was, in fact, convicted in 1982 on the basis of false testimony. So he's like a lot of people who've spent more than a decade on death row. He's had nothing but loss after loss, one court after another denying him, one set of attorneys after another not adequately representing him. And I think finally Mumia is seeing that with his case being hard fought, with the support around his case increasing, his case is finally getting the attention of courts, and hopefully it will ultimately turn around and he will get a new trial. But as I mentioned earlier, while he's enjoying some success now, the road ahead is not as clear as we had hoped it would be because of the change in the federal law.
And finally, Len Weinglass, you mentioned earlier how expensive this case is right now with 11 investigators and all the work that you all have been putting in. Who is paying for this?
Well, Mumia's had about 12 years of experience with attorneys and investigators who are paid by the state, and that experience has been a very bad one. That's true of most poor defendants who are on death row, and almost all people on death row are poor. It's one of the shocking examples of what happens here in the capital punishment context, is that the people on death row really aren't represented well because they're represented by state-paid attorneys. I don't mean to say that's always the case, but that's the case in many cases, and it was the case in Mumia's. Now we are defending the case largely through funds that are raised by his support networks and Black United Fund in Philadelphia and the Bill of Rights Foundation in New York have been receiving funds and checks, many of them in very small denominations, but adding up and enabling us to try to keep abreast of the expenses. But we have always been operating in the red, and we still are. And all the help that we can get will certainly assist us in being able to put on the evidence that we need and find the witnesses that we're still looking for.
Leonard Weinglass is lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Both will be in court this morning. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a debate on U.S. role in the Middle East. Then we'll be talking about the first ever National Latino March in Washington. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We'll be right back. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Today in Washington, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will participate in a Middle East summit sponsored by President Clinton. The current crisis in Israel began 1 week ago when the Netanyahu government opened a tourist tunnel near one of the holiest sites in the Islamic world. The move ignited a wave of Palestinian protests reminiscent of the Intifada. By the week's end, 52 Palestinians and 14 Israelis were killed in the worst violence since Israel and the PLO signed their peace deal in 1993 at a Rose Garden ceremony here in Washington. Yesterday, White House spokesperson Mike McCurry was asked about the president's goals for the summit.
In persuading all of these people to come here, did we offer any assurances to any side that we would push for specific results to any of the specific issues debated?
We attached no preconditions to the discussions, but we asked only that the leaders arrive in a frame of mind to address the fundamental questions that will be before them over the next 2 days. How can we restore calm? What can we do to bring an end to the violence? How can we re-engage so that the process is advanced rather than slipping away into turns to reversing course?
Mike, has the U.S. found in consultations with other allies outside of the Middle East a continuation of the sort of anger at Israel that was being expressed sometimes last week about sort of precipitating this whole thing? And what, if anything, has the U.S. or can the U.S. do to allay this?
Well, we've expressed our view that the antidote to frustrations and exasperation are the type of dialogue, or is the type of dialogue that the president will help sponsor over the next 2 days. We're aware of the views of other governments. Those were reflected in the decision taken by the United Nations Security Council on Saturday. You're aware of our position on that question. We believe that the best thing that we can do and the best thing the international community can do at this point is to encourage the parties to directly address their grievances, their issues, their disputes, and to continue to make progress implementing the agreements they've already reached.
Mike McCurry speaking yesterday. He's the White House press spokesperson. U.S. policy towards the Middle East. That's what we're going to be debating today. I'm joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. He's a columnist with the New York Daily News. Our guests are Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum and Middle East Quarterly based in Philadelphia. We're also joined in New York by Norman Finkelstein. He's author of Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. His forthcoming book is called The Rise and Fall of Palestine. Well, why don't we begin with Daniel Pipes? Can you tell us what you think of the Middle East summit call today and what you think President Clinton should get out of it?
Well, I'm afraid that President Clinton has a tendency to pop off when it comes to the Middle East and do things too quickly. He went on a trip to Damascus 2 years ago with a week's notice, and it failed. And then he arranged on a week's notice a great big meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh in March to condemn terrorism, and it had no consequence. And I fear that this 2 or 3 day lead time for a meeting of heads of state isn't going to work this time either, and it's going to be a lot of show and no results.
What do you think the U.S. should get out of it?
Well, the goal certainly is to resurrect the peace process. The peace process, in my view, came to an end last Wednesday afternoon when the Palestinian police started shooting. I mean, there were a lot of disagreements till that point, be it on openings of tourist sites or Arafat's rhetoric or the withdrawal from Hebron. There are many, many issues between the two sides, but until that point, they hadn't used force. And when the Palestinian police opened fire, that changed the whole, it ended the negotiating process, changed the whole political relationship, and that needs to be resurrected now.
Norman Finkelstein, would you agree that the process broke down when the firing started by the Palestinians?
Well, I think the first point is to clarify is what is the so-called peace process. Essentially, the peace process is about Israel's attempt to pursue the Bantustanization of the West Bank and Gaza. That was the intent of the Oslo Accord. And up until recently, the Palestinians were acquiescing in their Bantustanization. Last Wednesday, the Palestinians, for the first time, engaged in resistance to that Bantustanization, and the Israelis then, according to reports, opened fire and Palestinian police against the spirit of the Oslo II Accord, joined with the Palestinians in reacting to the Israeli firing. So I think it's correct to say that the so-called peace process is breaking down, but one ought to have clarity about what that peace process is about. One also ought to be clear about what constitutes a violation of the so-called peace process. A violation consists when Palestinians fire on Israelis. Notice then all the commentary thus far in the media on the events of the last few days. It's been focused exclusively on Palestinians firing on Israelis. When Israelis fire on Palestinians, that's in keeping, that conforms to the peace process. Palestinians aren't supposed to fire on Israelis. Palestinians are supposed to fire on Palestinians. If Palestinian police torture and kill Palestinians, that conforms to the peace process. If Israelis kill Palestinians, that conforms to the peace process. If Palestinians resist their Bantustanization, that's a breakdown of the peace process.
Richard Pipes, what do you think? Daniel Pipes, sorry. What do you think of that assessment of the peace process?
Well, it's very hard to discuss the peace process in these terms, the so-called peace process, Bantustanization. These are all very strange terms that are, I don't quite know how to respond to them. There is a peace process in the sense that the Israelis and the Palestinians have agreed on a set of accords which basically say to the Israelis, you'll get security, you won't get attacked, and basically say to the Palestinians, you'll get autonomy and you'll get economic benefits from it. It doesn't promise everything to either side, but it is a reluctant compromise they reached 3 years ago. I think universally people of goodwill believe this is something that is desirable in itself. Mr. Finkelstein apparently condemns it and sees it as Israeli hegemony over Palestinians. Well, to be sure, the Palestinians aren't getting sovereignty out of this, or it's certainly not assured. But on the other hand, it is something which most Americans, in fact, overwhelming majority of Americans, see as something good in itself.
But what do you think of that idea that he put forward?
I may respond to that. If I may respond to that, I won't speak for most Americans since I haven't taken a poll on what most Americans think about the topic, but I'm surprised that Daniel Pipes is so well informed on the topic, is not used to language like Bantustanization. For example, I'm sure Daniel Pipes has read Meron Benveniste, the former deputy mayor of Jerusalem, his recent book, Intimate Enemies. In that book, Meron Benveniste, who's also the most authoritative Israeli scholar on the West Bank and Gaza, he refers explicitly to the Bantustanization of the West Bank and Gaza as the main consequence of the Oslo Accord.
So what are you doing? You're condemning it?
That language is not so odd. Let me make one other point.
Are you against it?
Daniel Pipes referred to the Palestinians being granted autonomy within their enclaves in the West Bank. That's exactly correct. What is a Bantustan, Daniel Pipes? As I understand it, that South Africans...
What are we talking about? Are you against this peace process, Mr. Vincent?
I'm not for or against the peace process. I'm here to clarify exactly what constitutes the peace process and then let the American people decide for themselves whether they're for or against the Bantustanization of Palestinians.
Exactly,
whether they were for or against the Bantustanization of South African blacks.
Let's just talk about the
Let
peace process.
Let them decide. Why
South
should
African.
You?
Are you hoping that the meetings today and tomorrow are going to lead to the successful resumption of the process?
I think the purpose of this discussion is to clarify exactly what's at stake.
Could you answer my question?
You refer, Daniel Pipes, to the Palestinians being granted no more than autonomy. The question I asked you, Daniel Pipes, is why the Palestinians, why are they only entitled to autonomy, whereas Israelis are entitled to sovereignty?
Okay, I'll
What's
answer that
the difference?
Question, and then you answer my question. I think the Palestinians are only entitled to autonomy because they are...
Subhuman.
Please, don't put words in my mouth. Because it is a... They have lost, basically, to put it most simply, in World War I, they joined the losing side.
Oh, it goes back to World War
I? In World War II, they joined the Nazis who lost the war. in the Cold War.
World War I, the Nazis? Could
I please answer?
Norman, why don't you let Daniel Pipes respond?
Okay.
In the Cold War, they joined the Soviets and lost. In the war between Iraq and the Allies, they joined Iraq and they lost. They lost, they lost, they lost. Every time they lost. And you know what happens to losers? They often don't get the results they seek. Now, they also have means of putting pressure on Israel, and they've succeeded in winning a substantial amount of autonomy. That's not sovereignty, but they have won autonomy, which someday may lead to sovereignty. We don't know. It's an open question. Final status talks will discuss them. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you hope that the talks today in Washington are going to lead to successful resumption of peaceful negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis, or do you hope that process is going to break down?
My hope is that Palestinians are granted their full and total human rights, their full and total human rights like Israelis. Unlike yourself, I do not believe that even if Palestinians lost 1,000 times, they've forfeited their human rights. They're entitled to sovereignty and self-determination, exactly like the Israelis.
Okay, but what about today's meeting?
I told you, I think your listeners understand perfectly that I believe the Palestinians are entitled to their full human rights.
Well, we've said that.
If the result of this meeting is to give Palestinians their full human rights, I totally endorse it. If the result of this meeting is to consolidate the Bantustanization of the West Bank and Gaza, I can't endorse it because I believe in the human equality of Palestinians with Israelis.
So you're
I'm
saying
not a
that
hypocrite.
You hope the meeting today fails?
If I can interject here, I'd like to ask Mr.
Please.
Pipes. You originally indicated that you thought President Clinton had jumped very quickly into this meeting without a clear plan. What do you see as the alternative to the negotiations that are occurring in Washington right now? Do you think would have been the correct path?
It's really not so much a matter of strategic goals as tactical ones. It is a general principle that when the principals themselves, when the leaders themselves get together, there's got to be a lot of spade work done. The aides have to gather and work out draft communiques. They have to get certain points established. They have to make compromises. And then the leaders get together, and they polish it off. They dot the I's and cross the T's. But if you don't have the basics worked out, the leaders are hard-pressed. They're busy people. Especially President Clinton now in the height of a presidential campaign, have a very hard time working out these essential points, these basic points. And so I fear that this was done with such haste that it won't be successful. To answer your question, I think the better way would have been to put it off a bit and to make sure that the spade work is done before the leaders get together. I think it's precipitous.
Daniel,
it's not a very profound criticism. It's just saying, I don't think it's going to work because it's done so fast.
In essence, what you have, though, now is a truce. Because in any other way, the fighting would have continued, although possibly not at the same levels. But I think the attempt here was to have a truce while there are attempts to work out clearly some kind of a compromise. But the essential, I'd like to ask both of you in terms of the issue of the tunnel, which the problem with the compromise on this is that you either close it or you open it, to what degree the tunnel has become representative of the issue of sovereignty and of goodwill on both parts.
The issue of the tunnel indicates, in a symbolic way, the problems that are occurring throughout the so-called peace process. The question is, if you notice in all the newspaper headlines and the media coverage generally of the recent events, it all refers to Israel on the edge, violence in Israel, headlines basically on that theme. The curious point is no violence occurred in Israel. The violence occurred in Bethlehem. The violence occurred in Nablus. The violence occurred in Ramallah. And the violence occurred in Arab East Jerusalem. They are not Israel. Those are Palestinian lands which are occupied during the June 1967 war, and under international law are occupied land. Nonetheless, it's the Israeli view, as the view of the mainstream media, as the view of the U.S. administration, that everything there belongs to Israel, except these tiny specks of land, these enclaves, which belong to the Palestinians. The Palestinians get the reservations, the Palestinians get the Bantustans, the Palestinians get the ghettos, and Israel gets everything else. Mr. Netanyahu's actions in Jerusalem are illustrative of that fact. The Palestinians are entitled to nothing. Israel is entitled to everything.
Ooh. Daniel, perhaps your response for either to this or to the issue of the tunnel?
About the tunnel. I see the opening of the tunnel as essentially a non-event. It is in itself a very minor act. I agree with critics who say that the timing and the manner in which it was done was not intelligent, was not sensible, was not positive, constructive. I don't think it was well done, and I would have a number of other criticisms of the Netanyahu government. That said, it's essentially a non-event. Or to put it slightly differently, there are a whole host of smaller points like this in which the two sides differ that doesn't justify the resorting to force. And that's why I, in my opening statement, laid emphasis not on the tunnels, but on the use of guns. That changes everything.
Yet, as a non-event, the Prime Minister Netanyahu is insisting that it will remain opened.
Well, at this point, once the guns have been resorted to and dozens of people have been killed, to acquiesce would mean to say that force works. All right, anything you don't like, Palestinians, that we do, that we the Israelis do, you can open your guns, you can shoot at us, and we'll acquiesce. You can't do it. Had the gunfire not been shot, then the negotiating process would have continued, and then possibly he could have or would have closed the door. Or, I mean, close that the tunnel door. But at this point, once the guns have been resorted to, it's awfully hard to give in to them.
Norman Finkelstein, what do you think?
Notice, incidentally, that the issue is only guns when they're pointed at Israel. When Israel resorts to violence, as it did a couple of months in Lebanon, and killed 200 people, that was fine. Do you know why? There wasn't a single Israeli casualty. When Israel shoots Palestinians, in this case 55, on the other side 14 Israelis are killed, the issue is not the Palestinians killed, that's okay. The only issue is when Israelis are killed. That's the peace process. Preserve Israeli life, Palestinian life is worthless. Palestinian life perishes, it doesn't count. When Israelis get killed, the peace process is breaking down. Let's have a summit.
Norman Finkelstein, what do you think of the idea that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu opened the tunnel knowing that this was going to cause this kind of reaction? I mean, in the past, it hasn't been opened. Once it was opened by the Likud government before, and they closed it quickly because saw the acrimony that it resulted in. The idea that Netanyahu did this to provoke and to undermine Yasser Arafat, that he wouldn't be able to control the response.
It's not clear to me. One can argue that Netanyahu was engaged in a provocation. To my thinking, it hardly makes a difference in terms of that particular action. The bigger issue is that action is as illustrative of an entire process, and that process is Israel's unilateral annexation of most of the West Bank, approximately 70% of the West Bank, and its ghettoizing of the remaining of the Palestinians, granting them, as Daniel Pipes calls it, this generous concession. They get to rule over their own ghettos, called autonomy.
And putting this now into the context of the presidential campaign, which, of course, we have to do, now Bob Dole is criticizing President Clinton, saying he better not make Netanyahu agree to any concessions, that he shouldn't put pressure on Israel. What does President Clinton have to gain from today? And let's ask this question to each of you. Daniel Pipes.
I think the Arab-Israeli peace process has been President Clinton's major foreign policy accomplishment, and as he sees it in fraying, almost ending, he needs to take steps to revive it, or else what does he have to show for all this effort? And so it's a definitely risky and slightly desperate effort to revive his major accomplishment in the foreign policy area.
Norman Finkelstein.
Nobody in the United States government stands to lose anything from this process. It takes no great powers of discernment or imagination to understand that politics is about power. The Palestinians are, relatively speaking, powerless. They're coming to Washington to take orders from the paymaster. He who pays the piper calls the tune. Mr. Mubarak stayed away for the reason that he knew that today was Thanksgiving. The turkey was going to be carved up. Mr. Arafat's the turkey. The Palestinians will get nothing. Israel and the United States will get everything, and they'll also get the blessing of Daniel Pipes.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. Norman Finkelstein, author of Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. It's out by Verso Books. His forthcoming book is called The Rise and Fall of Palestine. Daniel Pipes has also been our guest. He's with the Middle East Forum and Middle East Quarterly, based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds to discuss the first national Latino march on Washington. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Juan Gonzalez joins us from New York, columnist with the New York Daily News. On October 12th, thousands of Latinos from around the United States will be in Washington for the first ever National Latino March and rally in the nation's capital. According to the organizers, the focus of this march is to bring attention to the denial of civil and human rights to the Latino and immigrant communities, and to denounce the anti-immigrant and anti-Latino sentiment in the United States. Yesterday, White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta spoke to reporters about the budget deal that has just been reached and talked about the budget's impact on immigrants.
To the immigration bill, now do legal immigrants, do they get all the benefits that would be accrued to a regular citizen? Ordinary citizens?
Well, again, you have to remember that in the welfare reform bill, there were enacted in the welfare reform bill cuts on benefits for legal immigrants that flowed out of welfare reform, both with regards to SSI and food stamps and some other areas. Those still remain, but what happened in the immigration bill is that on top of these cuts, there were additional cuts that were added to legal immigrants in the bill that came through, cuts in health care, cuts with regards to providing AIDS patients with any kind of medical treatment, cuts increased deportation steps, thresholds that were increased in terms of bringing in family members. All of those have been knocked out of the final bill here. What we wanted to do was to make sure that we did not do an additional hit with regards to legal immigrants.
Such a vengeance against legal immigrants.
Well, Helen, I'll tell you, as the son of immigrants, I have a hell of a time understanding why they have such a problem with legal immigrants. I think immigrants are, in fact, what this country is all about.
And so forth.
They pay their taxes, they work hard, they've made this country what it is, and it's a little strange to me why they have this kind of vengeance against those who are here legally.
And that's Leon Panetta, White House Chief of Staff, talking yesterday at a news conference, being questioned by Helen Thomas. But we do have to remember it was the man he works for, President Clinton, who did sign that welfare repeal bill. We're joined now by Juan Jose Gutierrez of One Stop Immigration. He's a leading organizer of the March on Washington that's scheduled for next week. Juan?
I'd like to ask the first question to Juan in Washington. This year has seen in three different pieces of legislation, in the anti-terrorism bill that was passed earlier in the year, in the welfare overhaul bill, and now in the immigration reform bill that was tacked on to the budget passed yesterday. All of them had severe changes and attacks on the immigrant community of the country. To what degree have these attacks spurred the movement for the march that will be occurring next week?
Well, without question, all those very reactionary moves have promoted a strong felt desire on the part of Latino immigrants, and ultimately, I would suppose, on all immigrants, to do something, to demonstrate in a very tangible way that we are not ambivalent or totally unaware of the significance of these very, very serious steps on the part of government against immigrants. And so I would say that, yes, it has helped a lot in convincing many individuals that otherwise would not be willing to take to the streets to say enough and to make a commitment to be here in Washington to reaffirm our humanity and to say enough of this senseless discussion, where at the core of the issue is whether or not Latinos in particular as immigrants have the right and the acknowledgement of the rest of society to be viewed as human beings. We are humans, and we thought that that argument had long ago been settled. Excuse me.
Who do you expect to come to this event in Washington next week?
We expect all sectors of the Latino immigrant community to be here, as well, of course, as progressives from all ethnic groupings, youth, professionals, business people, all individuals that recognize that clearly the intent and purpose of all this racist legislation disguised as democratic discourse is nothing more than a very badly cloaked attempt at further discriminating our communities, at polarizing ethnic tensions even more than they have been over the years, and at really damaging the social fabric of our society. So I expect there to be a well-represented segment of every single sector of our community, young and old, men and women, professionals, and primarily working men and women.
Of course, the date that's been chosen, October 12th, El Día de la Raza, is also the anniversary of the day the first undocumented immigrant arrived on American shores, Christopher Columbus, the first immigrant sin papeles. I'd like to ask whether the fact that Congress will be out of session and, in essence, the rest of the attention of the nation will be turned to the presidential race is going to weaken the impact of the march at all, as far as you're concerned.
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. It has to do with the fact that we don't see this march as an end in itself. I would imagine that many of the thousands of people that will be making the sacrifice of making it all the way to Washington, D.C., do not necessarily like to march and to spend their weekends traveling far and away from family members and so on, just to march or just to be in the nation's capital, because that sounds rather dramatic. No, people are going to be coming here because they clearly understand that it's time for Latino community members to begin a process of playing a larger role in the decision-making process in this country. And so we're going to be coming in big numbers, understanding that there will be bigger and greater battles ahead of us in the next 4 years and beyond.
But do you have specific demands? I mean, this is an election year. You've got the candidates right there. One of the criticisms of the Million Man March that happened last year is that there was never anything specific. In fact, it was really called a Day of Atonement.
Right. No, we do have a political platform. which has been devised over the last 7 years by the over 1,000 organizations that today compromise Coordinadora 96, which is the organizing coalition. For example, we're demanding human and constitutional rights for all as a way of reminding Americans that beyond the fact that there's been a lot of problems with forming a society which is fair to every member of society, regardless of gender or race or whatever, we have come some ways, but we mustn't forget that now and go back. And so we have that philosophical statement at the core of our seven-issue platform. We also are demanding that affirmative action programs be maintained. We need them today more than in the last few years. And so we want to make it clear that we don't believe, as some would argue, that affirmative action has very little to do with Latinos. It's a very vital issue to the future of our community. And so we stand firmly for affirmative action. We also don't want public education to be denied to any child in America, irrespective of their parents' legal status. Children have nothing to do with parents' decisions to come to a country, and in this particular case, the United States of America, where there's a long tradition going back centuries where people have come here without documents. We also support maintaining health services available to needy citizens. To deal with the issue of unlawful police conduct, we are calling for the establishment across America of citizen police review boards. On the issue of labor, we want effective labor law reform and a $7 per hour minimum wage. We believe that effective labor law reform would level the playing field for working people that attempt to exercise their legal right to join unions. As it is right now, it is very difficult to join labor unions. And lastly, on the issue of immigration, we want an expedited naturalization procedure so that more of those over 10 million legal residents who are currently eligible to become naturalized citizens of the United States can vote, especially since many of the issues around immigration policy most adversely will affect them, and yet they have basically nothing to say about that. And along with that last demand, we're also asking that to the issue of undocumented migration, we must get back to the business of understanding that as a human issue, we must come up with humane solutions to the problem rather than with exclusively punitive measurements like the ones that were approved by Congress yesterday and signed into law by President Clinton, which essentially called for a dramatic increase in law enforcement along the border, which essentially translates into more arrest, more human rights violations, etc. We want some balance in that policy debate, and our belief is that if we expand the amnesty law, which was enacted in 1996 by Congress and President Reagan, to cover those individuals that can prove that they've been in this country prior to 1192, that would be a good way to begin seriously addressing the very, very complicated issue
immigration. I think that the reality is that while a lot of those issues that you raise might be commendable, the reality is, from generally speaking, from the polls of Americans who have been subjected to the anti-immigrant media barrage, there's very little support in the Anglo or even some sections of the African-American population for some of those issues that you've raised. I'd like to, though, get it a little bit deeper into the heart of why you think this anti-immigrant xenophobia has arisen at this time. Because I know, for instance, the reality, the demographic reality, is that as that the United States ages, as many of the Western European nations and Japan age with their baby boomer population, they're going to need larger numbers of young workers, of immigrants, because they're not going to be enough young workers in the country to support the aging baby boomer population when they're all in nursing homes or on Social Security. So the demographic reality of the future of the country requires more immigrants, yet you've got the xenophobia now against immigration, especially from Latin America. What do you think is at the root of this?
Economics. We all know, anybody that reasons these issues, that at the core of this very racist and divisive political debate, it's the concern that, as you correctly point out, we are going to have this increasing need for a cheap source of labor. And immigrants will continue to fill that role. Therefore, what the Congress of the United States, led by this very reactionary grouping, is attempting to do is to create the legal basis from where employers can then manipulate that scheme to extract greater economic profit from immigrant workers, specifically undocumented workers. And so, no, the flow of undocumented and legal migration is not going to slow down. In fact, it might be increasing, as all evidence seems to indicate. So then the question...
Well, I think one of the points of the current legislation that was made by some of the critics is that while you have doubling of the Border Patrol and you have increasing penalties for smugglers of undocumented workers into the country, the legislation actually lightens up on corporations who employ illegal workers.
That's
correct. For instance, it would not increase the number of Labor Department inspectors of the 350 additional inspectors that were called for in the legislation that was taken out and the increases in penalties to employers. For instance, there was just a company here in White Plains, New York, a building services company that was fined $1 million yesterday, agreed to pay $1 million in fines for having employed thousands of undocumented workers, apparently, according to the INS, knowingly, but the company denied that, still paid the $1 million fine. So that I think what you're saying about the economic imperative of the use of immigrant labor still exists. But my problem is I don't quite understand why then there is such a continuing xenophobia to the general population against immigrants.
Well, it's a cloak. I mean, it's basically to deceive the public into believing the government is, in fact, seriously addressing the issue of controlling the flow of undocumented migration into the country on the one hand, while on the other, creating the material conditions which allows employers to then go ahead and extract a greater profit from workers. In other words, by having all these laws, now employers are empowered to tell their undocumented employees, look, I'll hire you even against the law, but so that I won't be fined and have to pay the fine, what I'll do is that I'll pay you a dollar less than what you're earning now, or even less than minimum wage, so that I won't get into any legal trouble and financial trouble by having to pay big fines and so on.
Juan Jose Gutierrez, if people want to find out about the march on October 12th, where do they call?
Well, we have a national office, which we've had in operation now for about 2 months, and the phone number there is area code 202-293-5672.
One more time.
Area code 202-293-5672. And I would urge our listeners, especially in and around the Washington, D.C. area, that if they have some time and would like to come and help, we would very much appreciate it.
Well, Juan Jose Gutierrez of One Stop Immigration, we want to thank you very much for joining us, one of the leading organizers of the October 12th March.
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer in Washington has been Kenneth Mason. In New York, we had help from Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And don't forget, we have a job opening here at Democracy Now! It's the job of producer. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can write to Democracy Now! At Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!